If you know the provenance of that track, you'll know that that is Frankie Knuckles and Your Love. An absolute dance floor, not even a dance floor, a rave filler from back in 1988. The Summer of Love. For if you are somewhere between your mid-40s and your mid-50s, you will know all about 1988, what that meant. The huge acid house explosion that took off across the UK, later hit Ibiza and the whole thing. It was an incredible time. I'm grinning while I say this. And it's also the subject of, I'll talk to my next guest about. He wrote Class of 88, Find the Warehouse, Lose the Hitmen, Pump the Beats. When the Summer of Love hit Britain in 1988, Wayne Anthony embraced the bright new world of dance music, MDMA, and all-night celebrations. But alongside the E, his natural East End entrepreneurial instincts kicked in and began to organise the infamous Genesis dance parties for thousands of kids. Wayne soon became a key figure in the high-octane Technicolor rave scene. But it wasn't all sort of bright lights and good fun, because there were some very heavy characters that got involved with the scene. Here to talk, he lived to tell the tale, he lived to write the tale. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Wayne Anthony. Wayne, good afternoon to you.
Hello, and good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
I'm very, very... I've got a big smile on my face just hearing that, you know, just those couple of notes played just takes me back 20... I mean, difficult to believe it's 20 years ago now.
Well, to be fair, it's 30 years ago, mate.
Sorry, 30 years, even worse. Sorry, there you go.
That's so how old, you've missed a decade.
Well, it was quite good fun.
Well, that's what they say. If you was there, you know, you won't remember.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I just seeing, because I'm just going through the back catalogue of stuff to sort of to take us in and take us out of that. And if you think about how 1988 was in terms, I meet young people today, and I say, you know, we had a fantastic time during the 80s, and they just think the 80s was all, you know, shoulder pads and big hair and George Michael and you know, all that's Whitney Houston, but you know, sure. The acid house came out of nowhere and took us to a fantastic place.
Sure. Well, if you think about it, they were quite right. It was all about shoulder pads, and it was all Whitney Houston and all that stuff. And at the time, if you remember rightly, it was a lot about wine bars. So there was a lot of high-end nightclubs. There was a lot of wine bars. You had to dress up. You know, you had to have a shirt on, a tie, not necessarily a tie, but you had to have a shirt, a pair of trousers on, and a pair of shoes. And you had to look like you wasn't going to cause any trouble in order for you to get into a nightclub. And the acid house thing kind of came in at the back end of the decade. And with the new music came new fashion, came a new sound, and there also came a new environment by which to enjoy this new subculture. And that was one of the things that made it explode so rapidly, in that we went from this pop culture, which was really about being material and, you know, going to the right places, earning lots of money by way of the Thatcher method. And then suddenly we had like an anti-Thatcher movement, which wasn't really about politics at all. It was really about young people discovering themselves for the first time in their lives, you know, in a warehouse in the middle of nowhere. Because at the time, all of the nightclubs was closing at 2 a.m. in the morning. So there wasn't anywhere for anyone else to go. And for this new sound, which came from a warehouse, you know, it was Frankie Knuckles that actually introduced the sound at the warehouse over in New York, and that's where the term house came from. So they introduced the sound, and with that new sound, in a nightclub environment, it really didn't have the same impact. And so people and promoters, they saw other venues, warehouses in particular, in order to really introduce this new form of, you know, nightlife, because again, you know, this, our nightlife was all night. Our parties went from, you know, 9 p.m. to sometimes 8 a.m. So it was an all-night feature, and so it was completely new. You know, the kids were ready for it, because having lived through the 80s and lived through other people's music and other people's style and genres, it was now time for the young people to create their own form of entertainment. And that's what acid house did, and that's what the beginning of the whole rave scene. And that's what it did for the British society. And that's why everyone just went absolutely crazy for it.
I mean, obviously everyone went crazy for it. I mean, I just remember sort of belting around the M25 in a car because, you know, there wasn't, it was the underground thing that was so appealing. So your Friday night would this is, you know, pre-Facebook days, everybody would get a message on their particularly bulky mobiles. We'd be meet at a service station somewhere near the M25 and we'd be directed to, unless you were going to, you know, one of the warehouse clubs in London, and I remember raves in, you know, underground stations, disused underground stations. I mean, highly bleeding legal, but all that's, you'd end up in a field somewhere near Hampshire, as they famously sang.
Yeah, sure, because, and the reason why that happened is, in the beginning when we started doing the warehouse parties in London, they, you know, we were getting thousands of people, and we would get thousands of people would be inside the building, and then you would have thousands of cars and, you know, hundreds of people, you know, walking around the streets. And so what happened was it became really easy for the police to be able to, you know, set up a couple of roadblocks, and then they could practically shut your path down.
Yeah.
So we had to be very strategic in how we approached doing our events. So when we moved out of London, what we did was, in the beginning, we had secret meeting points. So we would never, ever tell anyone where the warehouse was. We'd print out flyers, and on that flyer, it will have a meeting point. When you went to the meeting point, someone at that meeting point would kind of judge you whether or not you were, you know, a policeman or something.
Yeah.
Or a journalist, you know, because we had more danger from the journalist than police, to be fair, because they were writing these really sensationalized stories. But if you didn't look like one of those two people, they would tell you where the event was. But it got to a point where there was thousands of people would arrive at these meeting points at the same time. So we had to find a better strategy in order to be able to cope with that amount of traffic in one place at the same time. So that's why we started moving outside London, and we set up these recorded phone lines. And so rather than everybody has to, you know, head to one certain place at a specific time, when we set out the meeting points and when we set out the phone line, once the address was released, it meant that everybody could, you know, come to the venue from wherever they were in the country. And that was really hard to stop. And it was really worked efficiently in order for us to get the party going.
And I mean, when you started first doing your first promotions, because I mean, the music was unlike anything else. It was coming out of, you said house music was coming out of New York and Chicago. I mean, it was an underground scene. I mean, like I said, everybody else's idea was a good night. It was dancing late to sort of Phil Collins and that lot. So
it was quite
incredible and organic how it suddenly took off and captured the imagination.
Certainly. I mean, it was a whole new genre of music. It literally was, in the same way that rock and roll or punk. I mean, this was the biggest subculture movement since punk rock. And so everyone was waiting for it. Everyone needed it to happen. Remember, everyone was walking around. They had their shoulder pads on, you know, those huge Motorola phones, you know, suits. And so everyone needed something to happen. And then this acid house sound came. Well, it started with the Balearic sound, which was really a mixture of the 70s and 80s stuff anyway. But organically, the acid house sound came out of New York. It came out of Chicago from the likes of DJ Pierre, you know, Derek May, Kevin Saunderson, Marshall Jefferson, you know, Tyree Cooper, and all these types of characters. These guys were creating music in their bedrooms. So for them, they only just discovered the sound themselves. And you might even be surprised to know that when they're, for example, Tyree Cooper, when his track Turn Up the Bass was like in the top 10 of the UK charts, they didn't even know. You know, so there was a lot of things going on, you know, in the background, shady moves that were going on within the house music culture, much like the great rock and roll swindle. So there was a lot going on at the same time.
And I mean, you can't talk about, you know, the acid house scene without saying, you know, the rise and proliferation of the, you know, there was a drug culture with it as well, and that drug was MDMA, E, whatever you want to call it. But it you know, it loosened boundaries, and suddenly people who probably in normal life wouldn't have been seeing dead talking to each other were chatting to each other and having a great time and dancing with each other and hugging.
100%. And if you really look back in history, You'll notice that any great leap, whether it be in music, well, mostly in music and subculture, there's normally some type of, you know, accelerator attached to that movement. And, you know, I mean, if we look at the Beatles, you know, we can look at Pink Floyd, Stone Roses, we can look at anyone you like, from that period. And because the fact we know there was a lot of drugs going around, you know, we can't write off what actually happened. So, yes, there was a lot of drugs going around. There was an MDMA in particular. But if you look at MDMA today, in certain countries, it's been decriminalized and it's being used for therapeutic uses. And in three countries in Europe, it's actually legal. So the about turn in that in that we was like, I guess we were the guinea pigs. You know, we were the thousands of guinea pigs. And, you know, for to give you an example, a lot for males in particular, you know, we all come from quite tough backgrounds. You know, we were all brought up never to show emotion, to be quite hard. And you could have the best friend in the world, and you might say to him, you know, I'll back you up any day, mate. But you would never have hugged him and said, you know, I love you. And for MDMA, that's what it did for us men. It allowed us to be able to look at the world and to realize that we had such love for the world and such love for the people. And MDMA gave us the courage enough to actually verbalize that, you know. So MDMA played a major part in it. I think we might have gotten there, but it would have taken a lot longer to get there. So MDMA, you know, in the 70s, the drugs that was associated with the 70s and the early 80s, I think some of them are accelerators for sure.
I mean, the thing is as well, I mean, because, I mean, the clashing of cultures, I'm just getting all sorts of memories from Jessica. It's coming flooding back, for example. I'm just remembering the flyers that we used to have. Remember those great flyers that you used to put out?
Yeah, sure. I mean, to give you an idea, the first flyer we ever did, it was very basic, but we printed up 300 of them.
Yeah.
The last flyer I did, we printed up 130,000, and we ran out of flyers a week before the event.
Oh, blimey. I mean,
So back then, you know, it wasn't all about superstar DJs or anything like that. It really didn't matter who was actually playing the music. So a lot of the early flyers, they would just say, our flyers in particular, it just said like top DJs, you know, private music business parties. And this was one of the things why we in particular was quite successful, was because when we broke into these huge buildings, we would write out lots of documents to support that we should have been there, that we actually had permission to be there. So we'd have a fake document from the people that leased us the building.
Yeah.
We'd have fake contracts from the lighting companies, from the sound companies. We'd have contracts from like Channel 4 or EMI or someone like that. And then, you know, I'd have a shirt and a blazer nearby. And when the police would come, I'd throw on the shirt and blazer, go out there with a clipboard. And we even had a guest list, and it would have lots of stars' names on it. And some of them would be crossed out as if they was already inside the building. And I'd basically go out there and just, you know, give the policeman the hell, you know.
This is the thing, because you know, you're doing this underground culture, it's all free and love and the whole thing, and you're doing this in 88, which is, the high point of Thatcher's Britain, and to put it mildly, the police weren't amused, were they?
No, the police wasn't amused at all. They created a police pay party unit, and it was headed by a decorated police commander named Kenneth Tappenden.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to know, well, I'll say this first, and what you'll be surprised to know, that for the first time in British history, it was in 1989 when the police pay party unit really formulated, and for the first time they was using computers, and they created a national database of names and addresses and people that were connected to Acid House, and all across the country they were all sharing this information. And then they would have these police hit squads, which would be, you know, maybe 40 to 50 policemen, you know, in vans. And they would be plotted all around the country, waiting to get news of where there might be three big events on one night and hundreds of smaller events. But they were always trying to close the bigger ones. Mm. So whichever unit was closer to wherever the big event was, they would come. But what's interesting to note is that years later, in documentaries on national TV, the same police commander, Kenneth Tappenden, you know, he regrets everything that they did, and he says that he wished that promoters like myself were his lieutenants. And he said, really, it was pushing the whole thing back underground, which created the criminal element, which I know you want to get to as well. And if you think about the criminal element, what actually happened was this. If you think about it, the national press were printing stories that we were taking home £500,000 every weekend. Now, to hardened criminals who were going to, they were robbing banks and they were robbing post offices for £20,000. So to them, we were this bunch of loved up hippie type kids running around drinking water, telling one another that we love each other. We're in warehouses that we've broken into. The police had abandoned us and the press were doing a really good job of turning all the public against us. So we became easy pickings for these criminal elements. But the good thing about it is a lot of the criminal element side of it, all of that really came out decades later. We kept it as far as away from all the ravers and all the party people as we could. And, you know, when people read my book, they're really shocked to know, you know, that I got kidnapped 3 times and that we went through all of this stuff. They're really shocked. It was totally kept away from all of the party people. So they had no idea, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, I suppose this is the problem, because I remember the press vividly saying, you know, outrage, shock, something must be done. Well, there was a law, wasn't there, that was trying to get passed, or that they didn't they pass
That's
a...
Right.
I can't remember the name. It was a number.
No, they created... What they did, in early 1989... They created laws, and one of them was mandatory 6 months in prison. It was a £20,000 fine and all assets over £10,000 taken off of you if you were caught staging a party. Now, they used the word illegal, but what illegal actually means, it means unlicensed. And to get a license at the time, because of our, you know, because of the reputation of Acid House, built up in the press, built up in the newspapers, there was no chance that any of us was ever going to get a license. So it was really a catch-22 situation. We knew we couldn't get a license. They knew we couldn't get a license. But they just carried on demonizing us. Because if you can see the same thing happen today. Because what they did was, the press, it was important for them to separate us from the general public. So they demonized us and they demonized us. This separated us from the general public. The general public then build up a real hate for us and a dislike, because the press are saying things like, you know, we're selling drugs to underage girls and how dangerous it is. Everyone's running around with guns and all this type of thing. And so the press were anti us. So the police were anti us. And it really left us open for like the police to come in, you know, kick everyone's heads in and do whatever they like. It left an open ground and we had absolutely no protection because we were only 22-year-old kids. You know, we wasn't gangsters. We were just somebody that found a new form of entertainment and a new way of spending our time, you know, considering, you know, that before that, the clubs were closing at 2. So it was a difficult time, but the criminal element of it, it was such a small part of it that, as I said, only the promoters that were going through it knew what was happening. So to everybody else, they were having lifelong memories. They were building lifelong memories. And 30 years later, you know, the crave and the memories are still as strong as they were, you know, back in 1987 and 1988.
I mean, I was going to say, because, I mean, you had ex-paratroopers coming through the walls and stuff to beat you up and you know, sawn-off shotguns being waved around. I mean, how you must have thought at some stage this isn't worth... I mean, how did you... I mean, I know it's in the book, but how did you, you know, did you fight back about that sort of thing? And was that what eventually, you know, because it lasted, well, should we say 2 years, that whole period?
I mean, it killed it in the end, yeah. It killed it in the end, but, I mean, you know, I was kidnapped 3 times at gunpoint, hoods over my head, tied to chairs, all this type of stuff. Now, I'm not a bad guy. I'm just a normal guy, you know. And at the time, I was very hippied out. And not only did they want the money, they wanted your money, they wanted your name, but they also wanted me to work for them, which I wouldn't do. So I said, I'd give you my money, I'd give you my name, but I'm not going to do it for you. And I was quite adamant with that. But yeah, I mean, the criminal element, these were organized criminals, you know, they were organized criminal gangs. You know, they were robbing banks, you know, armed robberies for £20,000. So for them, you know, coming to us, it was really, really easy. So I don't really blame them for focusing on us. But around that was just a tiny little piece of it, you know. Around it was this big, bright and colorful thing that was just so full of energy. It was just so full of love and light that it swallowed up this small component. And I realized that what I was doing was really important. Genesis, my company, we were one of the pioneering companies. And I realized that how important that the movement was. And I wasn't going to let, you know, the aggression and the violence of these guys. They wasn't at all involved in the scene. You know, these were just gangsters that came in from the outside. And I wasn't going to let them spoil it for us. And I wasn't going to let them spoil it for anyone else. And so that's really why I carried on doing it. I mean, after 2 years, you know, it became really strained, because remember, we had the press against us. They were writing stories on a daily basis. Even the tabloid newspapers writing stories on a daily basis. We had them against us. The government were making up new laws. It was getting really much harder. We had the nightclub industry was against us because no one was in their clubs. We had the drinks industry against us because no one was drinking alcohol. Everybody was drinking water, Lucozade or Ribena. So we had these really powerful entities up against us, you know, a young 22-year-old kid without a clue, you know. And so eventually it did come to an end, but the memories, you know, they live on forever, you know.
I was just going to say, it's funny, isn't it? Because now some of the pioneers, I mean, some people, and I'm going to get all mushy on you now, kept the faith.
Oh, that's fine.
And kept the faith.
I feel the same. I look at the world the same way today as I do back then.
Some of the people kept the faith and went through incredible experiences, whether they were in, like I said, in fields or in warehouses or in, you know, Bagleys or the Cross or wherever. And others, you know, others became much more corporate. I mean, Ministry of Sound now, for example, has become this massive, you know, leviathan of the music industry, and it's lost. There's, you know, they can hark back and bring out acid house compilations, but it's now a business.
Well, yeah, and I mean, well, it's like anything. I think anything that can generate the huge amounts of you know, turnover that the dance music industry can, because it is an industry, and so you kind of expect that. And with those types of industries, you know, you have a lot of corporations. They have turnkey solutions that basically swallow you up. And even if they don't swallow you up, what a lot of them do, because in the old days, I mean, obviously this is before music went digital, because you remember in the old days, they really had control of all the distribution and stuff like that. So they had control of how your record got to the outlets. It's different now because it's digital and we can get everywhere that we need to. So they really were dominant entities during that period. And you'll find that all of the underground labels, you know, most of them were signed up to the major labels. The major labels sucked it all up, you know, and it left people without a choice, really, because there was nowhere else to turn. The major labels, you know, they had the finances, they had the recording studios, you know, and they had the clout that you could just call anyone up and say, hey, you know, I'm launching a record with, you know, Virgin or whatever, you know, do you want a feature on it? So I think the business side was always going to come into it, you know. It was something that we could never stop. But The love, the heart of it, it's still really there today. And you could do a party for, you know, 50 people and have the most amazing time.
I'm just thinking, because, I mean, I just came in with playing Your Love by Frankie Knuckles, and that is still as fresh as it was when I heard it 30 years ago.
Let the Music Use You, that was another huge, huge anthem in during that period. I mean, God bless Frankie Knuckles, you know, and all of those DJs from that period, Larry Levan, because they really set it up. You know, we came out of disco, you know. But today, the dance music is in every country in the world. You just cannot get away from it. You know, like what you're saying about being a commercial entity, dance music is now lift music. You can get in a lift and hear me in McDonald's, you know. So we're waiting for the next big thing, I think.
Just take me back, though. Genesis, you know, the whole situation. Pick me out a memory when everything went right. You're standing there. You look across. Was there a moment you just went, this is the high watermark? This is as good as it gets?
Sure. I mean, I've been standing in a warehouse with 10,000 people, for example. A riot squad, this is one of my parties, the riot squad has come in to stop the party. They're in full riot gear. You know, they've gone over to the DJ stand. I've moved away from the DJ stand because I was upstairs in the back room counting out all of the money. And so our job was now to get the money out of the building because the police are closing the building down. And I remember, so we were on our way to a fire exit and we'd met all of these girls and they had like dungarees on and stuff.
Oh, I remember
We went up to them and we were like, do you mind if we'd like stuff loads of money down, you know, down your dungarees? So we had all these girls and we stuffed all their dungarees with money so we could get out of the building so we didn't look like the promoters with like loads of bags and stuff. And I remember going over to a fire exit, and we opened it, and there were some police there. But I remember in the background hearing the, someone on the microphone saying, you know, we're not stopping the party. And I remember the police were trying to stop it, and they turned the music off. And then I remember the lights went out, and I just remember all these lighters went up in the air, and this chant began, and it started off small in one corner, and it was, acid, acid. And there was like 8,000 to 10,000 people chanting acid in this massive warehouse. I mean, the police, they ran out of there as if we were all mad on LSD or something like that. But I remember standing there thinking, you know, this will never end. This is it. You know, this is how we should have been living years ago, you know. And so I had lots of moments like that where the energy would just practically lift you up from the ground. You know, you could really feel so much love inside of those buildings that you really did forget about what was happening outside of the bubble. You know, I forgot about being tied to chairs with hoods over my head because this was too big. This was too big to stop. And, you know, I will never, ever, to the day I die, forget standing in any of those warehouses.
The book is called Class of 88, Find the Warehouse, Lose the Hitman, Pump the Beats. It's out. It's been reissued now on Virgin Books. It's by Wayne Anthony. Wayne, if people want to find out more about the book, about you, do you do the social media thing?
I have a website.
Great.
classof88.co.uk.
Super. And what else are you up to now then, Wayne? I mean, if you just got a quick... Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, for the last 10 years, I've been working with... I founded one of the largest street art graffiti networks in Europe. And in the next few months, we're about to launch a Netflix-style TV channel. So I'm really excited about that. It's the first TV channel of its kind. It's called Spray TV. So look out for that. It's coming soon.
We will indeed. Wayne Anthony, author of Class of 88. It has been a pleasure and a privilege, and I'm grinning
my
watch.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed speaking to you today and speaking to everyone that's listening. Thank you so much. And, you know, just remember to keep the love, keep smiling, and we'll see you on the other side.
I'll play out a little bit of Promised Land. What do you think?
Listen, Promised Land was an absolute anthem. That is a perfect play-out set.
Wayne,
thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for your time today, Wayne.